Good evening, and welcome to another Fireside Chat. This is your host, Zany Mystic. My guest tonight is the co-founder of the Human Kindness Foundation and its award-winning Prison Ashram Project. It was originally created with Ram Dass. He holds an honorary doctorate from Chicago Theological Seminary and is the recipient of the prestigious Temple Award for Creative Altruism. Two of his books have inspired millions around the globe, and whatever titles and kudos he's received hardly describe this person. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Bo Lotbach to the show. Welcome, Bo.
Thank you.
Now, how are you going to follow that up? Just kidding.
I have no idea.
Bo, I think it might be a good place to start with how some of these foundations came about. How did this come about, and what triggered your awakening?
Gee, that's a small question, isn't it?
I know that's an whole hour right there. I was just reading the introduction to We're All Doing Time, and we can start there, or we can start with just having you talk about the Human Kindness Foundation, or wherever we want to go with this.
Well, it's your show, so start where you like. We're All Doing Time does have a little bit of how we got involved with prisoners. Basically, a couple of my family members were in prison, and at the same time, Sita and I had wound up in an ashram. This is in the early 70s. And when we went to visit my brother-in-law in prison, my sister's husband, we just noticed that we had given up in order to enter the ashram and live a very disciplined life to gain a lot of spiritual insight. We had given up many of the freedoms that he would have given his right arm to have when he was in prison, and it just began striking us that if a prisoner was tired enough of seeing himself as a convict and you know, looking at what he's not able to do, if he wanted to reperceive his environment as sort of an involuntary ashram, that he could get a lot out of it, just like we were getting out, getting a lot out of living a lifestyle where we didn't have sex, we didn't have access to restaurants and movies, we just wore all white, didn't have any variety of clothes or jewelry or anything like that, and a lot of the, you know, working all day without getting paid for it, a lot of the conditions of ashram life or monastic life are really similar to prison life. It's not a slam dunk, because prison is a very hostile and often dangerous environment, as you know, but we weren't trying to do a naive, simplistic thing of just painting a smile face on the prison experience, but we were saying very seriously, but you could work with this in the same way that monks and nuns use their time, and you might be able to get more out of it. So that's how it all started.
You started the original Prison Ashram Project with Ram Dass, did you not?
Yeah, at the same time that we were visiting my brother-in-law and becoming motivated to do something in the prison system, we had also met Ram Dass and become friends, and his first book, Be Here Now, had been distributed to most of the prison libraries around the country. It was free copies that he had sent to prison libraries, and he was beginning to get mail from prisoners asking further questions after they'd read his book. And since he was sort of living on the road and just going around from city to city giving talks and that sort of thing, when he stayed at our place for a few days and we talked about our mutual interest in prisoners, he asked me if I would take over that correspondence since I had an address and he didn't. And and so he just funded us out of our pocket for basically postage and incidentals for the first couple of years as we were building up a reputation and a correspondence with prisoners around the country, and my letters then became newsletters, and the newsletters, you know, became little booklets, and after a few years it was obvious that we had a very thriving project, that there was a surprisingly great amount of interest among hardcore convicts. We had thought that kind of meditation and yoga-oriented stuff that Ram Dass was spreading and that we were doing in the ashram might be of interest to people who are in prison for psychedelics or, you know, certain drug offenses, but we didn't really think that these things were going to be of interest to the mainstream prison population, people who had been thieves and killers, and, you know, and that was the big surprise to us, was that there was a tremendous amount of interest in using that time for something more productive than just becoming a more hardened criminal.
Hmm. Now, you've been doing this for quite a few years. You must have had contact with thousands and thousands of people, and I know from the letters in the back of the book, We're All Doing Time, that there's some pretty eye-opening material in that, in those personal letters that people have written you. And would you want to share some stories about some of the meetings, some of what you do as far as going out into the prisons and actually talking to prisoners and stuff?
Well, right now I'm basically living on the road. I'm speaking to you from Wichita, Kansas, where I'll be going to prisons in the next few days. And I left North Carolina, where our office is and where it's been my home for the past many years. I left there in December, and this is now August. And
wow.
And about every 3 months, I fly home for about 3 weeks and sort of catch up on things there and help out around there, and then I fly back to wherever my car is and continue the road trip, and it looks like this may be my lifestyle for some time to come.
Wow.
So I, at this point, though, as you say, I've been doing this a long time. We started in 1973, so it's been 33 years now, and
good Lord.
There are copies of my books in virtually every prison and jail and lockup situation that you can imagine, and so what I do in prisons is basically just show up. I'm kind of a combination between Mr. Rogers and Mother Teresa for prisoners. When I step onto a prison yard, it really is like Mr. Rogers showing up at a ghetto elementary school or something. You know, you just hear from across the yard these big, burly, tattooed convicts saying, "Hey, Bo! Bo, look over here!" And so it's a very affectionate and intimate relationship that I have now that I'm almost 60 and I've been doing this basically all my life, and there's generations of prisoners who have heard my name and have seen We're All Doing Time. And there isn't a prison that I go to where I don't hear at least from a few people, "Your book saved my life, your book saved my life, your book saved my life." So they're meeting this guy that they have tremendous affection for. And it makes the work really just being the family elder who shows up and reinforces all the good stuff that they're trying to do and the work they're trying to do on themselves. And,
well, I have to admit I'm one of those people because I did some time some time back, and when I was in jail, I was fortunate enough to stumble across We're All Doing Time in there, and I'm telling you, it was a life-changing experience, and I cannot recommend that book enough for everybody. It's just such a wonderful spiritual tool, and there's nothing left out of it. I mean, you know, really, don't you? You must find that we're all really in jail in some sort of prison of our own creation.
You know, We're All Doing Time was a very difficult book to write. It took me 7 years of a lot of frustration and just tearing up the whole thing. This was before personal computers. So I was working on a typewriter, and I'd get 400 pages, and I'd begin reading from the start, and I'd feel like, oh, I got too complicated again. I would just throw it all away and start from page one.
Yep.
And it was 7 years of that because my aim was to present the most profound scriptural wisdom from all of the great religious and philosophical traditions in an extremely clear and simple way for people with an average of an eighth grade education. And how to make it deep and simple, which is the title actually of another one of my books, Deep and Simple.
Okay.
When we think of making things simple, we usually assume that we're dumbing them down. And I don't think that that's necessary in with spiritual truths. Jesus himself said, except you become as these little ones, you can't enter the kingdom. And he often made remarks about being simple-hearted and you know, be as innocent as a lamb. And so I know that spiritual truths don't have to be sophisticated and esoteric and hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, it took me 7 years to finally come up with a book that we felt really made the deepest teachings of the world completely accessible to anybody who had enough interest to read it.
Mm-hmm.
The big surprise with We're All Doing Time was not that it was popular among prisoners. The big surprise was Village Voice named it one of the 10 books everyone in the world should read. And
oh, yes.
The Zen master, Roshi Bernie Glassman, said it's one of his 10 top all-time spiritual books. And that was the big surprise, was that people completely outside the prison experience were also saying, we've really got a great book here. And so now We're All Doing Times in about 5 or 6 languages, and it's just everywhere I go. When I went to Sri Lankan prisons a few years ago, and in the middle of a maximum security prison in the jungle of Sri Lanka, surrounded by elephants and tigers and stuff,
wow.
There's an inmate who holds up a copy of We're All Doing Time. And
wow.
It's just gotten everywhere.
Wow.
Which is, it's interesting because it became the prisoner's Be Here Now.
Yeah.
Ram Dass's Be Here Now had become the same kind of book for the, you know, for our 60s generation.
Oh, yeah.
And it just spread everywhere, and it just really hit a nerve for everybody. And then, you know, We're All Doing Time really came out of that same, Ram Dass and I have the same guru, and it came out of that same kind of force, and now We're All Doing Time has done the same sort of thing that Be Here Now has done.
Hmm. Speaking about gurus, it seems that there's been somewhat of a shift, you know, when the Beatles were around, and it was the big thing to find a guru, and there was Rajneesh, and I did my thing in a Gurdjieff Uspensky school, but it seems like there's a shift to finding the guru within ourselves. Do you think that that's accurate, or is it still necessary to find a living teacher, or is it maybe a little bit of both?
Yeah, I don't think it can ever be really pinned down to one thing. I think some of us wind up having the fate or destiny of being with somebody in the flesh who is really something completely other than a human being, somebody who has gone through the death and rebirth of the spirit. But I think it's very rare. Rajneesh wasn't that. He never was.
No.
Muktananda wasn't that. Swami Satchinananda wasn't that. Amar Desai wasn't that. Swami Rama wasn't that. What's happened in the West is really unfortunate, because a whole bunch of swamis and yogis came, and it's still happening, really. There's this whole sort of crop of Westerners in my age range, and between 50 and 60, who are calling themselves self-realized masters, and they have disciples now, and they give satsang. And what's a shame about it is that the real guru is an extremely rare event on earth.
Yes.
And when we try to, I mean, there are people who call Deepak Chopra a guru, and all he is a wealthy celebrity.
Yes.
You know, and he's very, I mean, bring Deepak into a room with me. I'll eat him for breakfast. He has no power. He's a wealthy man who loves, he's very attached to his goods.
Yeah.
He writes in one of his books, fulfill every material and non-material desire you ever have. Make and spend money lavishly. Now, America is already destroying the world ecologically because of our consumerism.
Mm-hmm.
And he's telling people to make and spend money lavishly and fulfill every desire you ever have. That's insanely irresponsible.
Yes, I agree.
So, well, the problem is that what happens is we set people up as gurus, and they're not really gurus in the first place. And then when there's a sexual scandal or some kind of scandal that involves them, then the cover stories of all of the New Age magazines like Yoga Journal and New Age Journal and all, the cover stories are all, find the guru within, the age of the guru is over. Well, no, that wasn't a guru in the first place.
Right, right.
So the age of the guru has never been an age, and it's not over. And there are going to be some people on earth who wind up, I mean, the reason that my guru is when I was 8 years old and my father was paralyzed, I began having dreams every night of this man that I thought was an imaginary figure just in my own dreams. I called him my magic man. And then when I'm 25 years old and I pick up Be Here Now for the first time and I open it and there's a picture of Neem Karoli Baba, Ram Dass's guru, it's my magic, man.
Wow.
And
wow.
It was inconceivable to me. I never even considered that maybe he was a real figure.
Hmm.
And I saw him maybe 100, 200 times in my dreams when I was a boy.
Wow.
That'll get your attention.
Yes.
And then when I make friends with Ram Dass and I share that experience, I say, so I have some very strong connection with the saint. Tell me more about him. And then Ram Dass says, well, he's called the saint of Karma Yoga. Okay, well, what's Karma Yoga? Karma Yoga is the yoga of selfless service. It's devoting your entire life to serving mankind.
Wow.
Okay, well, sign me up.
Oh, no.
I mean, it's really not this complex, sophisticated, esoteric thing. The guru sometimes comes into somebody's life. There's no invitation. There's no, I didn't go out seeking. And then on the other hand, there's all these thousands of people who get the money to travel to India and they seek a guru. And maybe they don't find that because they're looking too hard, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's always the age of both. There are certainly realized beings walking around, and they are not flawed and fallible, but they're also extremely rare.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole bunch of people who do, of course, need to find the guru within. And when you find a real guru, the real guru hardly ever tells you what to do. And a real guru just kind of turns you in on yourself and says, if I'm really who you think I am, then I'm always with you. I'm inside of you. I'll be, like Jesus said at the end of John, I'm with you until the end of the world. And so a real guru turns you inside yourself anyway.
Yeah.
To find him. But what we do in the West is we say, so just trust yourself the most, and you don't have to go to anybody other than yourself. And that's just more of the egomania that we live with in a consumer culture, and that's not really a good alternative to a guru.
Yeah, yeah. You've been doing this for so long, for 33 years, and there's a lot of talk about people awakening and that we're approaching the end date of the Mayan calendar in 2012 and so on and so forth. Have you noticed anything different? Is there an acceleration taking place, or what do you notice about the globe?
Well, I spent 3 years in retreat many years ago reading the Bibles, the scriptures of most of the world's religions, the ones you could name offhand.
Okay.
I've read all of their Bibles. And so to some degree, that means I'm sort of a student of world history, because religious history is world history
right.
in a large sense. And what I see happening is there are cycles, there are world cycles that we go through, and civilizations rise for a few hundred or a few thousand years, and then you know what they do? They fall. And there are periods of prosperity for a few hundred years, and you know what they're followed by? They're followed by periods of adversity. And these are natural cycles.
Yeah.
We can blame Bush and Cheney and the genuinely vicious people who are in charge of the country right now and who are sending the Roman legions around the world to subjugate the world for American business interests. That's all true, but it's also, they're just the instruments of this very natural phenomenon of a world cycle where our civilization has risen to the point where the American people have become dependent and entitled and addicted to luxury at the expense of most of the world. And so our children are, right now, American children are the most violent children who have ever been born on the face of the earth,
mm-hmm.
statistically. American children are the most homicidal children, the most suicidal children,
mm.
the most drug-addicted and medicated children who have ever been born on the globe.
Mm.
And that's the kind of thing that happens when a civilization becomes too proud, becomes attached to its luxuries. You know, you have Jesus saying, lay not up your treasures where moth and rust doth corrupt and thieves break in and steal. He's talking about materialism.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives us the answer, the reason why he tells us not to lay up our treasures in material goods. He says, because where your treasures are, that's where yours is going to be.
Mm.
And we've fallen into that classic trap. We laid up our treasures in consumerism and luxury, and that's where our heart is, and our kids are angry and violent, and they're not sure why. I was talking with a woman the other day whose 15-year-old daughter is starting to get into trouble. And I said, what does your daughter believe in? And the woman looked at me like this blank look. Like she didn't even understand the question. And I said, what does she think is really beautiful or noble or sacred? And she just kept looking at me like she couldn't compute the question.
No, geez.
And she said, I don't think my daughter believes in anything. She goes to the mall and hangs out with her friends.
Oh, wow.
And I said, well, of course she's getting in trouble. Because human life is very deep, and our dominant modern lifestyle is not deep. And so there's this disconnect. And kids, American children, are the angriest children who've ever been born. And they don't know why. They think they want more. Mm-hmm. They think they want more of the goods that moth and rust doth corrupt and thieves break in and steal. But they keep getting more. They keep getting their Xboxes and their Jordan sneakers and all that. And they're angry. Mm-hmm. And they're violent. And they feel that life is cheap. And they don't really believe in anything beautiful, mm-hmm. noble, anything worth sacrificing themselves for, anything that they look up to. They have this built-in cynicism about the world and about people's motives. And oh, the Dalai Lama, yeah, he's got an angle too. Mother Teresa, she was just doing what made her feel good. I mean, well, that's a very sad part of a civilization in descent.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how it all works with the Mayan calendar and the dawn of a new age and so forth, but I know that it would be dishonest not to acknowledge that our culture right now is in a serious period of adversity and decline.
Yep.
We need it. This is a good thing, not a bad thing. We are brutalizing the world for our cheap Nikes and stuff, and we have to stop, and we're not going to stop on our own. We're too addicted. And so we're losing our children. We also, besides having the most violent children who have ever been born on the face of the earth, we have the greatest number of people on the face of the earth on antidepressant medication.
Oh, yeah.
And so our adults are depressed more than any other people on earth. The people in Africa who are so ravaged by epidemics, the people in India who are so poor and they're starving. Our adults are actually unhappier than the people in any other nation on earth by the numbers of prescriptions written. And our kids are more violent than anybody else on earth. And so we have to say, well, maybe it's not such a bad idea that our civilization is in decline, because something has got to, in AA, what's called an intervention. Something has got to be an intervention for Americans, because we're just addicted to our coffee, our cell phones, our Blackberries, our iPods, and they're not making us happy and they're not making our children happy, but we're addicted to them, and that's all we work for, is to pay for all of that stuff. And something's got to stop us in our tracks.
Yep.
Al Gore feels that something is going to be something like the oceans rising 20 feet and changing our civilization that way. Jimmy Carter feels that something is going to be that our federal government falls because it's being so horribly run, and you know, or that other nations attack us. Whatever the something is, I think that it could be something more like the Great Depression of 1929.
Yeah, that's what I think.
But something needs to happen. It's not like, oh, what can we do to avoid it?
No.
It's what can we do to welcome it, in the sense that we know it's going to be a real hard period, but that you and I are going to be calm and compassionate and prepared to go through that hard period and to come out as better human beings, making less selfish choices about what kind of world citizens we're going to be. And then, you know, then our children are going to be needed. You know, in India, there's nobody who's just who's arbitrary or unnecessary in a family. The whole family has to pitch in for that family to eat.
Yeah.
In America, kids know that they're not needed at all for their family. They're not needed to build the house. They're not needed to cut firewood for the winter. They're not needed to grow the food. We have kids who just aren't needed for anything, and it's a very mixed message when we tell them to go to school and learn. So what, so they can make a lot of money? They look around and they see all this money, and their parents are taking antidepressants, and nobody really knows which end is up. And people really need to be needed. People need to put out to expend a significant amount of energy. But if you feel like it's all just sort of just completely up to you, nobody really needs you for anything, your family's going to get along just fine whether you help out or not, then there's a resentment that builds up, because people need to feel their value. And I'm in prisons these days telling convicts, listen, while you've been shut away from being able to be addicted to consumerism and overstimulation, the mainstream culture out here has become terribly addicted to buying products, hiring experts, and being overstimulated, multitasking day and night.
Mm-hmm.
So we need you guys to come out and show us what real men are like,
mm-hmm.
calm and strong and patient and kind.
Mm-hmm.
We need you guys to come out and show us what it's like not to be addicted to consumerism and overstimulation.
Wow.
And prisoners really hear that. I went into Soledad a few weeks ago, and I was an hour late getting in because they were giving me a hard time in security. And so I go into the chapel, and there's 200 men sitting in the chapel, and they've been there for an hour and 10 minutes without anybody coming in to tell them that I was on the grounds and just to be patient or anything. Nobody explains anything to convicts, you know that.
Yeah, I know.
So these 200 men are in the chapel for a 2 o'clock workshop, and I don't get in there until about 10 after 3. And I walk in the back of the room, and I just marvel to myself, this is a quiet room. People are having quiet conversations among themselves. There's no feeling of impatience. There's no feeling of frustration. There's no feeling of irate anger or anything like, hey, it was supposed to happen an hour ago. Where the hell is he? There was no anger toward me. Nobody even asked me for an explanation because they're kept under conditions where everybody's rude to them all the time and nothing happens the way it's supposed to and nothing is fair. But in response to that brutal conditioning, the human qualities they've had to develop is to learn how to stay centered,
mm-hmm.
learn how not to feel so entitled when things don't go the way they think they're supposed to.
Mm.
And then I go to Boulder, Colorado, where 50 times a day, if you live in Boulder, somebody will say to you, are you comfortable with it? Lance, are you comfortable with my saying this? Lance, are you comfortable if we turn the conversation? Are you comfortable? Is this the way you want it? And I encountered a bunch of rude, impatient, uptight people in Boulder. Because that's what human beings develop in response to being asked if this is exactly the way you want it all day long.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm telling these guys in Soledad, we need you out here.
Yep.
We need you to come out and remind us what it means to be somebody with quiet self-dignity who's not a junkie for every bit of stimulation and every pampering. I mean, that's how consumerism works, is to pamper people so that you spend your money with this place instead of that place.
Mm-hmm.
And guys in prison aren't pampered at all. When you and I have a problem out here on the streets, we are strongly encouraged by the mainstream media to do one of two things, or both, buy a product or hire an expert. When people in prison have a problem, they don't have money to buy a product, and they don't have experts around to hire. And so they have to do what human beings have done for about 4 million years. They have to reach inside for inner strength, and they have to rise to meet the challenge that they're being given. And sometimes they have to turn to somebody next to them and trust that person and create a bond with somebody who's in the same sort of situation they are. This is what human beings are built to do,
mm-hmm.
and people on the outside aren't doing it. You want to quit smoking, you go to your doctor and get a patch inserted under your skin these days. That it's just, it's crazy. People on the outside are convinced you can't do anything on your own. There is no inner strength.
Mm-hmm.
Spend money.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first message of the American president to the American people after 9/11? The first message was, don't stop shopping. Show them they can't destroy us.
Yeah.
So the culture out here is about shopping and spending money.
Mm.
The culture in prison is, you're on your own, buddy. And so a lot of people in prison, certainly not everybody in prison, prison harms people terribly, but I'm talking about thousands of men and women that who read We're All Doing Time and things like that, who I interact with, who really are reaching in and developing inner strength and patience and forbearance and all the qualities that people on the street are losing because they're just so harried day and night.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting reversal, but prisoners that I talk to understand that I think that they have value mm-hmm. to give us. And knowing that he or she has value, that's the most important thing that happens in a person's life,
mm-hmm.
is knowing. I mean, this 15-year-old girl that I mentioned a little while ago, what value does she have to anybody? And she knows it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, her mother loves her. So there's some abstract thing where She's one of five kids, and she knows, yeah, my mother loves me. So, but she's not needed for anything. She's 15 years old, and she's not needed for anything. She's not needed for the family support. She's not needed for her to, the upkeep of her school or her home. And that's the situation that kids are in America. They know they're not needed, and so they feel they have no value, and they're pretty angry about it. And they just try to drown themselves in games and video games and sex and drugs and consumer culture because they just don't know which way. They don't know that the problem is that they don't feel they have any value. Because they're being taught in the consumer culture that the whole goal and purpose of life is to enjoy yourself and to have goodies.
Yeah, yeah.
And they keep trying to do that. And the missing piece is human beings need to feel needed.
Yeah, yeah.
We need to feel like the world would be a little worse off if we weren't here. And mm-hmm. kids don't feel that way. Most adults don't feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yes. you certainly have hit that on the head. do you find, I wanted to ask you about people in jail having mystical experiences and spiritual awakenings. Do you find that there's a that there are more that are having those experiences while they're in that kind of environment?
Well, it's certainly an environment where at least you're slowed down enough, you're stopped cold enough from your ceaseless agitation that it has the potential for you having a very deep spiritual experience, maybe
right.
a mystical experience. I certainly know a lot of prisoners who have, but... you know, there's a little bit of a caution in focusing on that too much because I asked a great rabbi that I was with once. I was playing guitar for his talks for a few days, and I had heard him say in one of the talks at a synagogue that mystical experiences or experiences of God, you know, can never be deliberately gained or anything. They're always like an accident. When they happen, they just happen. And so I asked him later that night when we were alone, I said, Shlomo, if mystical experiences are always an accident, then why do we work so hard doing all these spiritual practices and living the way we do? And he looked at me and he said, to be as accident prone as possible. And that's it. If you want to get hit by God's truck, you need to get out on the highway. And so getting out on the highway is cleaning up your life, your morals, your diet, meditating, getting your body in good shape, having your heart open, and not being full of bitterness and fear and all. That all the spiritual practices, they can't guarantee us
mm-hmm.
getting hit by God's truck, but they can get us up on that highway where at least the truck rolls by every now and then.
That's wonderful. Very good. I noticed from my own experiences that the jail experiences of the prison system seems to be pretty corrupt. I mean, I don't think I would want to single them out because I think the whole political system is corrupt. But in particular, it seems that there's a push to build prison systems and to find ways of housing people there and keeping them in and out in a cycle of you know, being in prison because it's a big money making. That's not a racket. What do you think about that?
Well, certainly, I mean, the introduction about 15 years ago or so of the private prison idea was a terrible step for our problems of crime and punishment
mm-hmm.
because it does put the profit motive into incarcerating human beings. There was a study done in one state of the same exact inmates when they spent time in the state-operated units or they spent time in the couple of private prisons that the state had contract with, and they found that the inmates had 9 times as much good time taken away from them. You know, good time is like for every 2 days that you have no infractions, you get a day off your sentence.
Mm.
And that in the private prisons, it was 9 times as often that they had good time deducted from them instead of credited.
Huh.
And it was the same people with the same behavior. And the conclusion was that private prisons are a business where they get money per head, per bed, per day.
Huh.
And they're not especially interested in anybody getting out earlier.
Yeah.
And so there's that corrupt motive. But I think in California, you've got a bigger problem than economic corruption. In California, you've got the CCPOA. And I feel like that's like a Death Star of the CCPOA is your California Correction Peace Officers Association. It's the guards union, basically.
Ooh.
And yeah, you had a Jimmy Hoffa type character named Don Novy who built the CCPOA into the strongest political lobby in your state. Now, I just went through a couple dozen of your state prisons in April and May, and I've been in probably 1,000 prisons now all over the world. I've never been in a system that felt more that it was run by it's a corruption of power rather than corruption of economics.
Yeah,
there is a power thing going on with your guards union. You know, Schwarzenegger appointed this woman, what's her name, to run the California Department of Corrections. She had been a warden at San Quentin.
I don't know.
Her name will come to me.
Okay.
He appointed her about a year and a half ago. She has completely good credentials in the prison system. She had been a warden for many years at San Quentin. She won all kinds of awards. She had good results at San Quentin from her policies and all. And she was the one who renamed the California Department of Corrections the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And she just, and that was what Schwarzenegger wanted. She was going to put an emphasis on programs and rehabilitation again that had been slighted over Pete Wilson and Gray Davis and all. And she battled the guards union, the CCPOA, for about a year and finally resigned just a few months ago. She cannot run the system with the guards union really running the whole state.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't mean just the prison system in the state. I mean the CCPOA is the strongest political lobby in California, period.
Yeah.
It tells the governor what to do. That's the force you've got who wants more prisons built, and they want more prisons built for a simple reason, because then that needs more guards. So they're the largest union in the state. They're the most powerful union in the state. They have an enormous amount of funding, and they're so arrogant that I showed up at California prisons. Now, Governor Schwarzenegger is the CEO of California. The prisons are under his authority. There are posters in your California prisons that the CCPOA has put up in Governor Schwarzenegger's prisons that have three guards pointing fingers at the camera and the photograph with real angry looks on their faces, and the caption says something like, "You're not going to get away with this, Governor. You know, you want a fight, we'll give you one." There's a word for that. That's treason.
Wow.
This is a state institution. He's the governor of the state.
Wow.
And they're in open insurrection and defiance of the governor of California.
Wow.
And the person he appointed to head the California Department of Corrections and the thrust of rehabilitation that he wanted to get back into the prison system, because every intelligence study shows that it's really stupid to treat people as badly as you do and just to lock them up for longer periods of time.
Yeah.
And the guards union basically just tossed her out on her ear.
Wow.
And openly defies the governor in his own institutions.
Wow.
So that's the problem you've got in California. It's partly about money, in the sense that the guards union is very powerful, and the more prisons you build, the more guards they have, the more dues they'll collect, and the more power they'll have. But it's not the same as quite the private prison industry simply making corporate profits.
Mm-hmm.
It's not money in that sense. It's money about political power. And the guards union has all the power for your state system, and it's not in good hands. And I met some very decent California prison guards, but they all wear this mantle of authority.
Mm-hmm.
They know they're in charge.
Yeah.
They know how strong their union is, and you can feel it even in the sweetest prison guard walking by and talking to you. It's a fascist, Nazi kind of confidence.
Yep.
They're not mean. They're not evil one by one, but the kind of confidence that they walk around with is a confidence that is evil.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I've seen that just in the small town that I live in the last year or so. The police force has gone up by 10 times what it was, you know, and now they have modern trucks and, you know, there's no crime here. And, you know, they all sit around at the freeway entrances waiting for people to speed by now, and I've been stopped for nothing with nothing at all.
Mm.
And, you know, and they're so smug about it. You know, it's just, I left California years ago because I thought it was becoming a police state, and that was 35 years ago, and I see no reason to change my opinion.
Yeah. Well, it certainly happened already in the prison system, and I'm not sure what to tell your listeners constructively to do about it, except that the citizens of California have to begin in some way to challenge the power of this enormous union called the CCPOA. And you've got to go after it somehow. You've got to weaken it somehow, because the governor of the state appointed a really good person to revamp the Department of Corrections, and she could not do that against the power of that guards union, and she quit. Jeannie Woodford is her name.
Okay, Jeannie Woodford.
Jeannie Woodford quit, and she was probably the best thing to happen to the California prison system, and she couldn't do her. She was just totally disempowered by the power of the guards union, so that something has to happen to weaken that force in your state government, and I don't know exactly how. And if you build more prisons, of course, it's not going to weaken.
Right,
it's going to strengthen.
Right, and it seems to be an ongoing project to build detention centers in addition to prisons. It's a federal thing now, so
yeah.
I mean, we could go off on a complete tangent with that one.
Well, it's really just, it's like what I was talking about American kids before, and if the real problem is that they don't really feel that they have any value to anybody, and yet the solution that they're trying to throw at that problem is just to get more consumer goods and to get stoned and drunk and all that,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, that's such a sad situation, and it's really the same way with voters and the prison system. And you know, if the real problem is that we need more people like Jeannie Woodford to help people get out of prison, get back on the streets in a productive way, et cetera, and yet instead of addressing that, the solution that we're throwing at things just from the media being whipped up by all the ads that the CCPOA endorses and politicians getting cheap votes, the solution we always throw at it is build more prisons and make it strong, make the three strikes law stronger, and then it's just going to be like the kids. We're going in completely the wrong directions.
Absolutely.
To address what's really the problem.
Absolutely.
And we're going, it's part of what happens when a civilization falls. Our civilization is really falling into open madness, and people need to, individually, you and I, need to stop being part of that madness.
Yeah. Well, I've opted out as much as I can possibly do to get off the grid.
Hmm.
I noticed that there's a growing methamphetamine problem too in America that seems to be raging all, you know, almost out of control, like a wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like that's pretty much interconnected to what you were talking about, you know, with not having any purpose and not having any spiritual connection or sense of connection at all.
Yeah, if you don't believe in anything, oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, I'd want to shoot meth too.
Yeah.
If there was nothing to believe in, there was just nothing except get through the day as high as you can.
Yeah. Well, I know you probably have a lot of very heartwarming stories of things that have happened with people, you know, that you've been in contact with over the years. Do you want to share anything like that?
Well, the most heartwarming stories in prison work are to see people who are the rare ones who do get the opportunity to do something that gives them value, whether even if somebody has a life without parole sentence. I mean, I have one friend named Rick Smith in the Alabama Department of Corrections who has a life without parole sentence, and I mean, he's never going to leave those prison grounds. He's already been in about 27 years, and he's become a man of peace. He's become an elder in the prison population. He's the head of a therapeutic community that has about 100 people kicking drug problems, and he's in for a very violent murder, and so he has credibility with the prison population as a big tough guy, and he can make peace sometimes between gang factions, and
wow.
He's taking responsibility to be a serious person in the community that he lives in, and then I have several people who have been on life sentences or very long sentences and gotten out and turned their lives into drug and alcohol counseling rehab or working with kids or whatever, they really get the point that I make when I give talks in prisons, is that it's not good enough to just get out and make a good living for yourself. My friend Bud, who did 18 years in prison for murder, and he's been out 3 years now, he works for a nonprofit as a drug and alcohol counselor, and his salary is $27,000 a year.
Oh, wow.
And he got an offer from a friend of his who owns a trucking company now. Bud and I both got our CDL, Class A CDL, commercial driver's license. We can drive tractor, trailer, rigs, or anything. And he got an offer to come and drive long-distance tractor, trailer, and he can make $75,000 a year.
Oh, wow.
And he talked with me about it, and he said, you know, he knows he's doing a lot of good with hundreds and hundreds of addicts, people who might go to prison if not for somebody like him, and he's the manager of a recovery house, and yet it's a third of the salary that he could get driving a truck, and he loves driving trucks, and I said, but what do you want your life to be about? Is it about salary? And, I mean, you already killed somebody. You spent 18 years in prison.
Yeah.
What do you want your life to be about? And I'm very proud of Bud that he kept his job at $27,000 a year, helping people rather than taking a job that he could get $75,000 a year doing something that he enjoys.
Yep.
And these are choices that people have to make, and their life is going to be a consequence of those choices. It's not really always about what's best for me.
Yep.
That's what has plunged our country into the decline of a civilization, is that we bought into this. It's only about Lance. It's only about what Bo wants.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not true. It's never going to be true that
we can
reach after our personal goals and personal happiness without considering what is our greatest value to the common good.
Yep.
So the prisoners that I know that I'm really proud of and that I'm just happy to, I feel privileged to know, are hundreds and hundreds of people, thousands of people, who really get the messages in my books and all and significantly change their lives. They go from being some of the most vicious and worst people you could ever imagine to being some of the best people you've ever been privileged to meet,
mm-hmm.
in and out of prison.
That's awesome. It's really awesome. You know, that's something that, there's a price to pay there, but, you know, the price tag is low when you see what the price tag is for being immersed in the material society that we're in.
Yeah.
You know, there's no amount of money that can compensate for love or the feeling of giving of yourself and knowing that was that's authentic.
Yeah.
I was reading a little bit about your ranch, and it sounded kind of interesting. Is that something that you are building as kind of like a retreat or a haven, or?
Well, it's the headquarters of Human Kindness Foundation is a 70-acre piece of land in North Carolina, and it's not something we're just building. We got there in 1994, and mm-hmm. I've already built about 20 buildings there, and it's served many purposes over the past 12 years. Right now, it's in a very quiet phase because I've been on the road for almost a year, and I'm the main mover and shaker there. And so, we run the Prison Ashram Project, which is our oldest project, and we get about 500 or 600 letters a week from prisoners all over the world, and prison staff and families of prisoners, and we send out our free books and tapes and CDs and that sort of thing. So that takes a few people, basically the mm-hmm. you know, the full work week, and the farm and the gardens and the wood shop and construction, all of that are sort of quieted down right now. We're in a period where we had been taking people as their parole plan for the last 12 years. From all over the country, people, ex-cons, would come to join us for 3 to 12 months. Some of them stayed several years and help out with the work and learn a bunch of skills and all. But now the Interstate Compact Office in Raleigh has denied our last person, and it doesn't look like they're going to be cooperating with us for a while, and we're taking that as sort of a coincidental sign that since I'm gone anyway, it's just time for us to be quieter there and not do as many programs.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bunch of stuff that goes on there, but it's not as active as it's been. And we've had a lot of really good and powerful experiences with having people come out of prison after 23 years. Bud was 18 years when he came to our place, and living with us for a while and kind of reintegrating that way. And now it's really just a few people who are handling all the mail and sending out the books and not doing as much other programs.
Do you see any books on the horizon for you? Is that pretty much something that you feel that has been done and your work is in action? Or,
well, it's a tough question, Lance, because I've never really been keen on writing books. I've always had to be convinced to write something, and I spent a year in silence recently, in total silence, and a lot of it in total solitude. And I'm a little cautious. I think that people rely on words too much,
yeah,
and I think there are just too damn many spiritual books for sure.
Yeah.
One of my books is called Just Another Spiritual Book, because I'm really ambivalent. You know, people say it's a really good and helpful book, and yet at the same time, it's just another spiritual book. And
yeah,
people really need to change their lives, not just read books.
Yeah.
So I don't really see myself right. I've been mainly involved since I came out of silence. I've been passionately involved in singing, songwriting, doing a lot of music. I'm doing concerts when I go around doing all these prison workshops also.
Oh, wow.
I have a new album coming out. I have my third album coming out in October. So I've been much more involved in music than in the idea of writing another spiritual book for adults.
That's wonderful. Well, there's spirit in music after all. You know, what's the name of your album?
The new album is going to be called Eyes So Soft. It comes from a very ancient Sufi poem. But I have two CDs out now, and people can see all the things, the books and CDs and tapes and stuff about from me at our website, humankindness.org.
Okay.
And the new album, as I say, will be out in October, and songs that I've pretty much written as I've been living on the road. And you know, I went to Pelican Bay a few months ago. I wrote a song called Pelican Bay. Wrote a song called Travelin' Blues, and that's on the album. And so I've just been traveling around, giving prison workshops, preaching in churches, and when I have some time on my own on the road, I've been writing songs. And I do concerts about twice a month as I go.
Wow.
I'll be doing one here in Wichita next Friday night. But my board of directors sort of threatens me that there may be another Bo Lozoff book, even if I don't write it, because some of these talks that I'm giving are taped. And so they may transcribe some talks into a book.
Oh, that's a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
You have so much to offer, Bo, I'm really awed by the work that you do, and if people are interested in participating, let's say somebody's inspired by this show, can they find out more about how they might participate in their own communities by contacting you? Or you have a free newsletter on your site, too, don't you?
Yeah, there's a lot people can do, and people can get in touch with us by going to our website, and there will be the address and phone number there. And we don't have an email address that people can get in touch with, so we just don't have enough staff.
Mm-hmm.
We get 500 or 600 letters a week and many phone calls, and we just don't have enough staff to start sifting through hundreds of emails as well. So
they can
get the contact information from the website, but they're actually going to have to dial a phone or put a stamp on a letter to get in touch with us. But anybody is welcome to write us for information or call us and get on our mailing list. And we have about 50,000 people on our mailing list at this point. About 40,000 of them are prisoners.
Wow.
About 10,000 supporters and activists and prison staff people and people like that. It's so they sort of, what they have in common is they all receive our newsletter a few times a year and sort of stay in the loop of what I'm doing and where I'm going and what things other people are doing. And our newsletters have transformation interviews with the kind of prisoners that I was talking about earlier who have really turned their lives around and are becoming serious people in their own communities. And so there's a lot of good stuff that people's ideas can be sparked by getting in touch with us.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, it looks like we're almost at the end of the hour. Is there anything you'd like to share with us before we have to part?
Well, just as I was saying earlier, I feel like our culture is heading into a period of difficulty, and I would just encourage people to strengthen their spiritual practice and their deeper perspectives and simplify their lives a little so that they're not in this overstimulated rat race is just all of your energy is going toward paying for stuff because we are in for some hard, we're already having hard times. When our children are the most violent people on the planet, those are hard times.
Yep.
So we're already really in hard times, but I think we're going to get more and more in hard times, and we have to become simpler and stronger people.
Yep.
So that's what I would encourage people to think about, how their lives can become simpler and stronger.
Wonderful. Well, I agree. That's a beautiful message. And Bo, it's been an honor to speak with you. And many blessings to both you and Sita and all the projects you work with. And thanks to Sita for connecting me to you so that we could bring your message to the world.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Lance.
Oh, thanks so much. And have a good journey there with the inmates.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye, Bo.
Bye-bye.